This is Ask the Investigator, the podcast that navigates the high seas of professional investigation, gives the warning signs of when it's time to stop being your own Dick Tracy and call a professional, and offers tips on what to do before making that call to help your cause. Now, here's your host, Ken Cummins.
Hello, and welcome back to another edition of Ask the Investigator. This is our ninth podcast. We have eight posted on our website at capinc.com, capinq.com. You can also find us on Google Play, iTunes, and Stitcher. And I hope you'll take a listen. We have a very good one this week. We're going to talk about the real-life PIs versus the fictional portrayals. And here to help me with that is my right-hand man, Christian Duvall. Hello, Christian.
Hello, everyone.
How was your summer?
Summer's going well. And good. Eager to resume our podcast.
Yes, we took a little break for the summer. And before we get to the other co-host, I want to introduce Tim, our production manager, who's sitting in the middle here. Hello, Tim.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for letting me make my on-air debut on the show. Been here for every episode. Glad to be back today.
Yes, we're going to get you more involved in talking to the guests and asking questions later on.
I always thought my mom should have been a private investigator, so I have a little bit of knowledge domestically. So.
You always thought your mom should have been.
Well, she figured everything out, so that will be my contribution to the show.
Okay, good. And then joining us at the mic this week for the first time also, although she's been with us since the beginning, helping us put these podcasts together, is Sherry Schweitzer. Hello, Sherry.
Hi, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for stepping up here, and we're looking forward to your participation. And we're going to start with you because you, I know, read crime novels. You watch the TV and films and the movies and the TV series on crimes, and you've been involved with us in analyzing the world of private investigators now for about 8 months. How would you contrast what you think a real-life PI does as opposed to what you see on TV or read about in the novels?
Fictional PIs are always men. They're usually down on their luck. A lot of them are tough guys. They wear trench coats. They're heavy drinkers and smokers. And a lot of them solve murders. And they always tie the case up in a nice little tight bow without any problems. And in real life, they're not always men. We've had women on here who are PIs. I know a woman who's a PI who looks like a little Jewish grandmother. And I think she is a little Jewish grandmother. And their work is diverse. They do background checks for employers, or they check out marriage partners or potential marriage partners. And they might help with criminal or fraud investigations, but they don't break the law. And you sometimes see that in the fictional ones.
Well, you see that a lot, but I'm going to let Christian jump in here first.
Well, first and foremost, disclosure, I'm wearing dark shades and a trench coat as a I'm addressing you. Just kidding.
Yeah, because Christian does that sometimes. He puts on lots of disguises depending on what case we're working.
I would say that investigators, there's a lot. It's just like the police, you know, if you watch cops on TV, they do segments of where the action takes place. But a lot of part of police work, just an investigator's work, is sitting around waiting, gathering evidence, information. And it's not as active as it is in the movies or in novels and so forth. Going to the courthouse, as you described, and yes, we're very big about not breaking the law.
Yeah, that is one of the things. Now, you have to, admittedly, the fictional PI, a PI in a novel, you have to keep the drama moving. So it has to move forward quickly. It has to be compelling. You don't get shots of people sitting in front of a computer screen doing search after search, really trying to get deeper and deeper into the internet and maybe get into the dark web to find out something. It's hard to have that kind of portrayal in movies or in books. But the big thing here is we can't operate in the gray areas, and most fictional PIs do. at one point or other. They get into the gray areas. They get deep in the gray areas, as our guest today is novelist George Pelicanos, and we'll talk about some of his PIs, private investigators, in some of his novels. But if you do that, you then become the issue, and you have just lost your case for your client, because your activities could cause the case to get thrown out or cause a witness to be dismissed or all kinds of repercussions that's going to jeopardize your client, and our clients are usually attorneys. It's going to jeopardize their client, whom they are charging big bucks to defend. So,
and to bring a real recent case, you have the case of Mr. Tobin, who was purportedly a private attorney for a lawyer Avenatti representing the porn actress.
Stormy Daniels,
that's right. And he had a 15 pages, he was a convicted felon with a 15 page rap sheet and was absolutely not licensed to conduct PI work.
So you want to
be careful who you hire.
Right. And you made the point, Sherry, that PIs don't solve murders, and that's generally true. I mean, I think Ed McMahon, who was a crime novelist of the 50s and 60s, I think he made that statement back in the 1960s saying private investigators never solved a murder, ever. But now we had this case with the Golden State Killer, and that was were several PIs involved in that, private investigators, and DNA specialists. And that one, I think you could come close to saying that group did solve the murder. You remember that case just a few months ago where they went through all the DNA testing and they narrowed it down to a family and group of individuals, and they presented evidence that the suspect, the person who was actually accused, was in that area or in the areas of these murders the years?
What's fascinating is they had gathered information from a DNA databases such as Ancestry.com, a third-party DNA database,
right,
to obtain the possible leads. And then they were able to obtain,
right,
the DNA of the individual and put two and two together.
Which has raised another level of privacy debates, but... So there's that case.
And you have the Grim Sleeper as well, the killer who was traced down to a slice of pizza. But that was police. That was not
that was
private
police,
detectives.
Yeah, and the only other one that comes close is I know some investigators who were involved in this, and the grandson was looking through the family papers one day, a box of papers in the family home, and discovered that his grandfather had been murdered. He knew his grandfather died when he was young, but he never knew the details. And the grandfather picked up a hitchhiker in Montana. Hitchhiker killed him. They caught the guy the next day or a few days later, and he was in prison for 4 years appealing his death row sentence, and mistakenly was given parole and vanished, and he'd been gone for something like 60 years. And when this grandson read this, he decided his commitment, his love to his grandfather was he's going to find this guy. And he used a number of private investigators. They located him living right in Arizona, right on the Mexico border, 3 feet from Mexico. And they coordinated that with the police in Montana on this old warrant, and they've got the guy arrested. But private investigators, when we get involved in murder cases, it's usually for something like that, or it's mostly criminal defense. We're either trying to find evidence that proves that the person charged didn't do it, or we're trying to find evidence to mitigate our client's role in it so that his prison sentence turns out to be a lot less. But we'll get into the whole... whether this is helpful, these fictional portrayals of private investigators is helpful or harmful to us. We'll get into that as we go on. Is there anything you want to add here before we bring our guest on? Because I really want to get to George Pelicanos,
yeah,
a novelist, and you know, he's been involved with The Wire and The Deuce and a number of great TV shows, TV series.
Yeah, what I would say, well, as aforementioned, we do conduct surveillance. We also dig through trash, unless it's on private property, but we also do, that's very exciting, going through someone's trash. And interview family, friends. We can do that as well, and a lot of looking, you know, searches for records and so forth.
Right. And the problem, just summing up here, the problem you get into if you get into the gray area, you do something illegal, is you lose your license. Then you lose your ability to run your business. And I know I had an employee whom I took on because he had he was a private investigator. He was a court appointed. He didn't like working for me because he liked the criminal defense cases. So he'd get a court appointed by the court for different attorneys, and he was faxing subpoenas. Subpoena law in D.C. used to be very loose, and you know, attorney can sign a subpoena. You didn't have to have a judge sign it. So he was signing the attorney's name, faxing subpoenas to the phone company, and getting unlisted phone numbers, and trying to track down a guy who was in a safe house. And he got nabbed for that, and they took his license away for a while. But then that's what will happen if we. I understand his impulses, but you really have to play by the letter of the law. So let's take a break now to hear about it from our sponsor, and then we'll be back with our guest.
The daily rigors of the real-life private investigator may not be as compelling as that of the PIs in books or on screen, but the outcomes are no less dramatic. Whether it's criminal defense, financial fraud, or reputational repair, a credible, experienced, by-the-book investigator can help you out of your jam and turn your life around. Capital Inquiries investigators will find a solution to your problem. Call 800-530-0766 for a consultation or email us at askinvestigator@capinq.com and check us out on the web at capinq.com. CapInc.com. Call today.
Okay, we're back. And joining us now is my favorite novelist for many reasons. One of the basic is that his books are all based here in D.C., and they are sociological and archaeological digs into that part of D.C., which has been here for 200 years. He never veers off into the national scene, which is the people who come here thinking this town belongs to them as part of as their spoils for winning an election or something. And he gets into that the real city that nobody ever sees. George, welcome.
Thanks, Kim.
So you heard our discussion of private investigators. Is there anything you want to add or disagree with?
No, just that, you know, in novels and films, I mean, you have to have conflict, and so often to have somebody who's kind of straddles both sides of the law is something that a fiction writer or, you know, showrunner uses to get people to, you know, watch a show or read their book. There are a lot of, in fiction and films, there's a lot of bad cops. There's not that many bad cops on the force, but a bad cop is it makes for an interesting character, creates conflict. So that's why you see so much of that, and that's why you see reality bent so much. I think the idea that PIs don't solve murders, it, more accurately, is that if you have somebody in your family that was killed, you wouldn't go to a PI office and with the actual eye on the leaded glass door, and walk in there and say, "Can you find my husband's killer?" You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You'd work
with
the police.
Right.
And but that's how just about every hard-boiled detective novel opens. Somebody coming to the office, PI's got a bottle of bourbon in the desk drawer. Sit down, it's a beautiful blonde. That's the setup. How many times does that happen to you, Ken?
Yeah, we get the people who walk in and they're think they're being controlled by implants in their teeth. So, George, your latest novel, which just came out this week, The Man Who Came Uptown, you have an investigator in there, and you have a very compelling opening chapter, but your investigator is not really a good guy.
Well, I don't, you know, he's not a villain either. I mean, I think that he rationalizes what he does because he's got a family at home, and he's trying to make a living. So him and his partner, who's a bail bondsman in Prince George's County, they do rip and runs, which is they basically what that means is they rob drug dealers and pimps and for their ill-gotten gains. So in their mind, they're not really doing anything wrong, although of course they're breaking the law.
Right.
That's an example right there. It makes for good drama.
Yes. Well, what do you base what do you base your PIs on? What when you form a character, an investigator in one of your novels? I know you have a lot of you do a lot of research. You have a lot. You base a lot of your stories on things that have actually happened. I've read your books, and I'll come across an alley where there's a murder, and I say, I've been in that alley. So how do you fashion your what do you consider when you're fashioning your character?
Well, I'm going to take the last guy that I had a series with, this guy Spiro Lucas. I know a bunch of attorneys that are independent attorneys or defense attorneys, and they public right. defenders and that kind of thing also. And they were telling me at the time, basically when I start out, I go out there and I just start talking to people and I say, you know, what's going on out there right now? And this was at the time that Iraq was winding down, the Iraq war, and they were transitioning into Afghanistan and so on. And some of these guys were telling me, well, I'm hiring a lot of veterans as my street investigators. And the reason is these guys in the military, they get used to waking up every morning and getting orders and having a sense of purpose. They know exactly what they're going to do every day when they wake up in the morning. And when they come home, they're kind of off center a little bit because nobody's giving them the orders and telling them what to do that day. And there's a little sense of purpose. So they were finding that these guys made really good investigators. They wanted to get out there and work. And they were unafraid, because of what they'd been through, they were really unafraid to go into neighborhoods that some rookie investigators don't really care to go into.
Right.
So I invented a character that was had that background, had just come back from the war, and he wanted to continue to see some action. And of course, he had a little touch of PTSD as well. So there were all those things going on, but it was based on a couple of guys telling me that they were hiring veterans at the time. They preferred them.
And I think Derek Strange, another of your investigators, was really kind of patterned on the punk scene here in the 80s and 90s, wasn't it?
No, Derek Strange is a middle-aged guy who was a cop in the in 68, a 22-year-old cop during the riots. And when he left the force because of what happened during the riots, he opened up his own shop at 9th and Upshur, and he had been there ever since, and now he's a middle-aged man. He did not come out of the punk scene, but now that you mention it, there's a lot of guys I know, private investigators in this town, who did. And we had a very specific music scene here, that Positive Force, which was unlike other punk scenes in the country, in that it wasn't, it was based around doing good things in the community, let's say that. So what you've got now is people that came out of that era. You see them a lot as teachers in the DC public school system, and you see some PIs, and you see people who are volunteers and that kind of thing. As they've come into their middle age, they've continued to go by that ethos, you know, of the Positive Force ethos. So
they're continuing to try to do what they think is something socially good and good,
that's
for,
right.
good for the community.
So the guy that I'm thinking of is, he only takes cases that are for the defense,
right.
And doesn't work for prosecutors, goes out there and tries to gather evidence, what you alluded to earlier, in cases, sometimes in RICO cases, that will help the defense attorneys in when they go to trial. And they consider that a community service.
Right.
And also it's a way to make a living.
Yes. Yeah. What they had here, right, what you're referring to is the DC hardcore scene. I think they had their own name for it. But it was a big, with Bad Brains and Positive Force and
yep.
different bands of that era. Well, let's talk about the second season, or your role as a producer of The Deuce, which is not based in D.C., it's based in New York, and it's really examining, I think, based on what I saw in season one, the rise of the pornography industry in America.
Right. That's the log line for the show, you know, the birth of porn and so on. But really, it's David Simon and I are partners on the show. We created it together, and we found this guy who had a bar that was mobbed up in New York in the 70s, and he was a good barman, and he was honest, and the way you get rewarded with the mob is they keep giving you responsibility, and so they were giving him massage parlors and things of that nature, and to manage, because he was bringing the money in honestly to the penny and that kind of thing. And he ended up, because of the world he was in, he knew the pimps and the prostitutes, and a lot of those people crossed over into the porn world. They became actresses and actors, and he knew everybody. And the stories that he told us were fantastic. But, you know, when it came down to it, we were reluctant to do the show because it's really a minefield. How do you make a show about porn without being exploitive, right? It's a very difficult thing to pull off. But we talked about the show being about labor, which we're very interested in, and how women were always then and even now at the bottom of the food chain with regards to labor, and how these women were selling, instead of working in a factory and making widgets, the product was their own flesh, and very often they weren't profiting at all from it. They were handing money over either to their pimps or the producers, or the mob were making all the money.
In that show, and correct me if I'm wrong, or in the first season, it appeared that the city of New York, the mayor's office, had a hand in this, and that they, to get the prostitutes off the street, to get clean up 72nd Street, or 42nd Street, Times Square, they offered, they turned abandoned buildings over to these guys to move the prostitution indoors and out of sight.
That's right. It basically was hiding what was going on, but it didn't do anything to quell it at all. It just moved it indoors, and
so it had government sponsorship. In a way,
yeah. The police were getting envelopes. Everybody was being paid, and when you started to look into the real estate records of these buildings, these properties, they were owned by society people. They were owned by guys on Wall Street, lawyers, doctors. Everybody, the money was funneling up to them. And so it was a very difficult thing to crack. But what happened was that economics is what ended up playing a part in the demise of that world.
Yeah. You actually went in and looked at the old real estate records back in the 70s on these location?
Yeah, it was Gail Sheehy, New York Magazine, wrote a very famous series of articles.
Oh, right, yes.
That exposed that, and then we have researchers that go in and dig up this material for us.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of things that happened in the 80s, which we will get to in our third season, not the least of which was the AIDS crisis.
Yeah. Well, what do you want to tell us about the second season before we move on to The Wire?
The second season jumps ahead to the late 70s when this that world kind of peaked. Pornography was basically legal at that point, and people were, they had artistic aspirations. They thought porn was going to be part of the American mainstream, and they were trying to make movies that were a little bit better and so on. And some of the women who were acting moved into directing, and they were empowered in that way. Maggie Gyllenhaal, who plays Candy, that's what happens to her in the second season. She becomes a porn director. When we met her last year, she was a prostitute on the streets.
Right.
So that's her evolution. But of course, they didn't see videotape coming, VCRs. What happens is when that, and this is right around this time in 78 when all this is introduced, the movie theaters started to vanish, because if you could watch pornography in the privacy of your own home, why would you go to a theater where everybody was in there doing, you know what they were doing? you could watch it with your wife or your girlfriend in the privacy of your own home, and that killed the the theater business and the actual movie business with regards to pornography.
Right. Oh, let's go to The Wire, because that is and will always be, I think, a classic in for HBO and in series. That's going to be the standard for a long time. And that was based in Baltimore. And David Simon, whom you mentioned, that was, I think he was the driving force behind a lot of that. And you got involved to write the dialogue and the characters because you have such a good ear, in my impression, you have such a good ear for the way people talk on the streets.
Yeah, he had read one of my books, and he called me up, and he said, he kind of downplayed it. He said, I just sold a show about drug dealers and cops set in Baltimore. Do you want to come write for it? And I was intrigued. I'd seen The Corner, which he had already done, and I thought it was fantastic, and I knew that his heart was in the right place. You know, we had, were simpatico there, so I went in and I wrote an episode, and it turned out to be the one where the kids kill Wallace, their friend. Uh-oh. It's kind of a famous episode.
Yeah,
and, and from then on, I was I had a deal with, and then I became a producer, and I joined the staff and all that, and I worked for the show for the run the whole 5 years, but I had a deal with David that I would always write the penultimate episode, which is the one where everybody gets killed. And that was my, so, you know, I'm responsible for the death of a lot of the beloved characters on that show.
Well, McNulty didn't get killed.
No, he made it.
And the guy with the scar, I can't remember.
Omar, he didn't make it.
Oh, he didn't make it, but no. He shot, well, we don't need to get into the weeds on this. You write about D.C., and that was very much Baltimore-based. Contrast Baltimore as a place of fiction, for settings of fiction, with the district.
Well, I think, you know, the people that have lived here a long time in Washington know that how much better it is in the city in terms of the crime and the homicides. We're talking about in 1989, I believe, the homicides were 469 or something like that in this city, and now it's the low 100s. It's 25% of what it was. And, you know, there's more jobs, there's better housing. Everything has improved in this city. And in Baltimore, it has not. And for anybody who says, like, we painted a downbeat picture of it, if you look at the show and you look at the rows and rows of blocks with abandoned houses and plywoods in the window, the only thing I can tell you is that those were not sets, those were locations. And if you go back to Baltimore today, which I have to go back to I call the Middle East, which is this area in the middle of town there, north of John Hopkins, off Broadway between Johns Hopkins and North Avenue.
Oh, yeah.
It looks the same as it did 12 years ago when we started shooting that show. The same plywood and the same windows. And not a lot has improved or changed.
Well, even downtown, just west of the Inner Harbor, which is a famous tourist place, and the football stadium, the Ravens Stadium and the Orioles Stadium, you go a few blocks west. That's starting to change, but it hasn't changed that much.
No, so, and I actually, you know, have a great deal of affection for Baltimore. It's a working-class town, but what happened is that when you shut down the factories and you take away the blue-collar jobs in an East Coast Rust Belt city, there's nothing left, you know? People who can't, in the old days, you know, not everybody goes to college, nor should they. But in the old days, if your dad worked in the union or your mom worked in the union and at U.S. Steel or wherever, or down at the docks, when it came time to be an adult and you didn't go to college, you too could get a job down at the docks or at U.S. Steel and get into the union and make a life for yourself and your family. That all went away. And the other thing that happened that I find very interesting is that people don't talk about Washington is that in 1976, the Metro opened here. Public transportation changed this entire city. The riots wiped the city out, and the downtown was dead. There was tumbleweeds blowing across, you know, downtown Washington.
Yeah.
7th Street, 14th Street, and 8th Street, the three riot corridors. But everywhere a metro stop opened, it bloomed up into a garden. And in Baltimore and in other cities, there's no public transportation. There's a bus system, and there's a half-ass little subway thing that goes down Howard Street. But basically, even if you get a job, you can't find a way to get to work. It's very important and to talk about public transportation in the life of the city. The metro here, even though it's dysfunctional now, was a great success for this town.
Yeah. All right. You had a sort of a sojourn to New Orleans, which
yes.
kind of was a little bit out of character, but I'm leading into your next project with this. But, I mean, a little bit, you know, you were in Baltimore, D.C., and all of a sudden you're in New Orleans, and you're not doing a crime series. You're doing more a series about the city and its people and its background. What inspired that?
Well, I think
we're talking about now Tremé.
Yeah, the show Tremé, which I think you and a couple other people saw it.
My wife did.
Well, first of all the shows that you mentioned, The Wire, Tremé, and The Deuce, are all about this American city. It's a dissection of an American city, and we're very interested in that. What makes cities work and what makes them malfunction, and why they're worth saving. So in the wake of Katrina, what happened down there, the hurricane,
right.
And by the way, it wasn't the hurricane that destroyed New Orleans, it was the flooding and the faulty
response.
Yes. There was the response and also the engineering of the
levees.
Yes, the levees. So anyways, I love music. David Simon asked me to if I'd be interested to come down and work on this show. And I did, and I fell in love with New Orleans as soon as I got off the plane. I mean, it was that simple. It's very, in a way, it's similar to Washington in that it's a, you know, it's a black city. I still consider Washington to be a black city with black culture. And it's a southern city, as is Washington, that people forget. We're south of the Mason-Dixon line. Food is very important here. It's extremely important down there. And music. And it's incredible. It's an incredible place. And that was what the show was about. It's how do we save this this city that's such a unique place in the United States.
And that led to your novella, The Martini Shot.
Yes.
Because that was also not based in D.C. for a rare instance for you, but really was more about your involvement with these TV series, producing these.
Yeah, it's about a guy on a film set, what happens to him when he, actually he tries to be an amateur sleuth, which is kind of disastrous for him, which I hate. It's my comment on the amateur sleuth genre, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Because those shoes, those books are ridiculous in my opinion.
But it's also a comment on the banality of a lot of TV shows, too, it seemed like.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot, you know, everybody talks about how much television there is now that you have so many choices, but that doesn't mean it's better. You
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah. Which brings us to your latest project,
yep.
DC Noir, and you're mm-hmm. I'm going to leave it to you to explain that.
Well, I wanted to make a film in Washington with Washington crews and film it 100% in D.C. in all four quadrants. And what I was trying to show everybody is that we can do production here professionally, make a nice product, and people can make a living working here on film crews, because ultimately that's my goal, is I want to get out of my own bed in the morning and go to work, because I've been living all over the country lately making these shows. So we took four of my short stories that actually appear in The Martini Shot. Well, three of them do. The other one was an original. And we made four films, and it's an anthology of D.C. crime stories set in D.C. and shot 100% in D.C. And I directed one. My son Nick Pelicanis directed one. He's in the DGA. Banga Akinabe, who's an actor on our shows, he played Chris Partlow on The Wire. And he plays Larry Brown on The Deuce. And then a guy named Stephen Kenegopoulos in Baltimore did a picture called The Confidential Informant from that book. So we're working on getting a distributor for that now, and hopefully people will be able to see it soon.
You're showing it at festivals now, I take it.
Yeah, we're going to take it to festivals first, yep.
Right. Well, going back to the man who came uptown, we talked, you know, you start off with an investigator, but then you quickly switch to the prison librarian.
Right. I got to know the actual D.C. jail librarian, a young woman, Danielle Zoller, and I was just fascinated with what she did. She, at the time, before they actually put a physical library in the D.C. jail, which they've just recently done, she used to go to a different cell block every day with a cart of books, and the guys would get in line, and she'd hand them a book, and that she chose. In many cases, she had chosen for the inmates. And then, you know, I've been doing reading programs in the jail and in prisons for about 20 years. So I do book clubs down there. I work with the Free Minds Book Club, which is a great organization. And I just wanted to use all this stuff and talk about how books can change people's lives. And particularly, I see what it does for inmates because, you know, if you're in a cell at night and you take a book into that cell and you open it up, and you're reading a Western or you're reading something in a historical novel or whatever, you go there. You're not in your cell anymore. And it's a fantastic tool to take your mind out of that box that you're in. And so the book is really a love letter to reading. And this guy, Michael Hudson, this inmate who's in on the D.C. jail awaiting charges, he gets bounced by that private investigator, which y'all are going to hate this. He does some witness tampering to get him out, which, of course, you guys would never do. But my fictional detective does it, and then he owes him a favor. And when the guy gets out, Hudson, all he wants to do is read books and go to his job. He's working as a dishwasher in a pizza place on 11th Street. And but this detective has other plans for him, and there lies the conflict in the novel.
Right. I guess it's fair to say that your themes are really struggle, redemption, and the ability to change.
Yes.
That's present in all of your work.
Yeah.
Does that come from your own personal background?
Yeah. I mean, without going into detail, I was, you know, I was a little rudderless when I was younger and didn't know what I wanted to do, and I got into trouble here and there, and then I got turned on to books by a teacher at the University of Maryland, a guy named Charles Misch. And it really focused me on what I wanted to do with my life. And you know, it's not a stretch to say that books kind of pulled me out. Books saved me. So this is my thank you note to that guy and all the teachers that have influenced. Everybody's got somebody in their life that reached their hand out and helped you, you know, at some point.
Right, right. That was, I just saw the documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor, Mr. Rogers. And at one point, he asks people to think, stop and don't for a minute and just think about who really had an impact in your life. And it was a very powerful moment in the documentary, and I think that there's always somebody.
That's right.
There's always somebody that you really want to pay homage to. So, Sherry and Christian, you've been awfully quiet here. You got anything you want to ask?
I got a question. When you're writing a novel, and for instance, do you walk in the city and see, oh, that alley would be ideal, let me stop here, take photos? I want to hear a little bit more about the technical aspect of what you do and write about.
It's a good question. I do walk around a lot in the city, and especially at night. And, you know, since you know, I've had an iPhone, which is your all-in-one tool.
Yes.
I go into alleys at night and I take photos. And yeah, I think about things like, well, yeah, that'd be a good place to, you know, that's an alley with three exits, so that'd be a good place to do a crime or, you know, kill somebody because you can get away. And but also, it's just kind of hanging out and listening to people. You know, it might be in a bar, or it might be on the metro, or whatever. It's just listening rather than being aggressive and asking questions and talking. And I like cemeteries. You know, like I like the Rock Creek Cemetery. I go there a lot and just walk around. For whatever reason, it gives me peace of mind.
That was featured in The Night Gardener.
Well, yeah, the cemetery in that one was the Confederate Cemetery over on George Avenue near Fort Stevens. Confederate, but they always get featured in my books. And you'll, for example, all the characters in this new book, when I talk about their houses, they're actual houses that I go and I sit on the street in my car and I watch people coming in and out of what they're doing, and then I think, you know, that'd be a good place for my character to live. So if I say in a book that it's a blue house with white shutters down on Sherman Avenue, then you can go down there and you'll see that house.
How long does it take you to write a book and do all the research and put it together?
You know, usually the research is 1 or 2 months, and then I shut myself in and I write 7 days a week, and I'll usually finish a book in about 5 months.
Wow.
I'm wondering what it's like to kill off a character. How do you do it? How do you feel?
Well, the decision should always be, or should it happen in the story? And you can't be afraid to let go of that person, because if it should happen, then you should do it. In the television show, these are real people that you're killing off. Meaning, when you kill off a character, you're firing the actor, and that's not easy. You know, we have there's several characters that aren't going to make it in this season of The Deuce, and I had to call them right when the script dropped, because we don't, as a policy, we don't tell the actors that they're going to be killed off until the scene's getting ready to be shot. And the reason for that is we don't want them to telegraph their performance. If they know in episode one that they're going to go in episode eight, they might start acting that way. And so that's not easy, honestly. And sometimes it happens to be the actors that you really like a lot, the people you like. You don't want to get rid of them, but you do it anyway.
And are you the one who break the bad news?
Yeah, I tend to be the person, yeah.
Yeah. What is this now? Is this your 21st novel, 20th novel?
21st book, yeah.
21st book, okay. Well, keep writing. They're great reading. They're page turners. They're very compelling. And they get into the issues that are in this community. You have characters who are finding a way to illicitly, I guess, send their kids to school in a better school district, which is a big issue here. You get into these kind of issues of community, and you get into the gentrification and the things going on in the community. So they're really fascinating to me. And I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We wish you the best of luck with this new book, about a third of the way through it. It just dropped this week. And good luck with the next two seasons of The Deuce. And I hope the DC Noir project gets off the ground, but it would be great to see this kind of work being produced here locally with local people.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it, everybody. Thank you all.
Okay, we're going to have another word about our sponsor, and then Christian, Sherry, and I will be back to wrap it up.
Ken, is the fictional portrayal of private investigators helpful or harmful to your industry?
Well, I would say it's harmful in this way, in that people come to us with a specific request. Say, why can't you get so-and-so's tax returns? Why can't you get my husband's tax returns, or, you know, my ex-spouse's tax returns? And so you saw there was a very good series a few years ago with Michael McConaughey and Woody Harrelson, where they're True Detective, I think it was called. And at one point, Woody Harrelson gets on his laptop and downloads a tax filing from 10 years before, which is he committed several felonies in doing that, because the only way he could do that is hack into the IRS. So people come to us with all these ideas they've seen PIs do on TV or in books, and expects us to do the same. So in that regard, we have to talk them down, and, you know, we have to bring them back down to earth and say, you don't want to do this, you're going to get sued. Then the issue won't be what you're trying to prove. The issue will be what you did illegally, and it'll just turn your world upside down. So, but, you know, we can work around it. I don't want to inhibit people like George, because these books are compelling, and they wouldn't be compelling. I don't know a book about myself would be that compelling. So.
Well, whatever your investigative needs, Capital Inquiry can propose a solution. Call 800-530-0766 today or email askinvestigator@capinq.com and learn more about us at our website at capinq.com, capinq.com.
Okay, so we're back. That was great. Any final thoughts, lessons learned here, Christian?
Well, I think there are certainly a lot of lessons learned. And I think it's wonderful, by the way, that our author has been writing books and trying to inspire inmates in prisons. And I think it's a fantastic venture. But yes, I mean, as we said, you know, investigators, if you were to film us on a day-to-day basis, you might fall asleep. I mean, you know, check us out. Follow us. We're going to the courthouse right now to get some records. We're approaching the clerk and accessing the terminal. I mean,
we're getting the surly clerk who won't cooperate with us.
Or we're serving. But I will say, there's a lot of stories that I've experienced throughout the work that are worthy of an action movie. You know, going to investigate a cartel, going to Mexico, a service of process, going up a light pole and watching a suspect or a person that who you're going to serve papers to. And there's a lot of excitement as well. But it's definitely not 90% of the job.
It's not, but you have to admit the life of a PI, even in our boring real world, is still pretty interesting.
Very much so.
Okay, I think that's going to do it for this episode. We're going to go out with the band Bomas Prendon. I want to say happy birthday to my daughter, and we'll be back. Something that tells you more about the world of private investigators.
You've been listening to Ask the Investigator. Send your comments, questions, and suggestions to askinvestigator@gmail.com and follow us on Twitter at #AskInvestigator. Thanks for tuning in.